Hi, film fans. Long time no speak. How are you? I hope this finds you well. You've had a great weekend. There is an abundance of wonderful things for you to enjoy. And also, we are thick and fast in awards season, which means many things. But for us here at Soundtrack, and it means that we have guests coming at us, at you, left, right and centre. So we are surrounded by wonderful talent who are more than eager to talk to us about their craft, their creativity and their wonderful productions. So we've got a lot on the way for you. But today we have a kneecap bonus episode for you on our latest episode of Soundtracking. As writer, director, Rich Pepiet, composer, Mikey J, and the three band members and stars of the film join me to discuss their brilliant comedy drama. Based very much largely on truth, it tells the story of the Republican Irish-speaking hip-hop band as they establish themselves on the Belfast music scene. Now, I did these interviews actually quite a while ago, but the film had such a limited theatrical release that I wanted to hold on to them to make sure that we could do as much as we could around the film being available on streaming. But also, I know that the film is definitely in a lot of conversations around award season. In fact, as of recording this on the 8th of December, the band are up for multiple British Independent Film Awards. And I have no qualms in saying that I think they'll definitely be walking away with a few of those today. So we thought this would be a good time to share the conversation, to encourage you guys to go and watch the film. Think about the first time that you watched films like Trainspotting or The Commitments. This has got that same vibe to it in terms of it's got such a unique and brilliant voice. So go and watch it, and then also I have everything crossed for them when it comes to awards season because they deserve all the applaud. We'll hear from Mikey shortly, but let's start with Rich and the lads after we've heard some of Kneecap's music. This is It's Been Ages.
Oh, it's been ages since we made the front pages. Since Jerry Leonard hiatus, back to annoying cons that hate us. It's back to basics, a scumbag who them shameless. Take more than that to tame us. All your fault cause you made us famous. All your fault cause you made us famous. Sticking our face in your papers, but we get loved by our neighbours. You keep track when you're giving favours. Sad, Curtis Gale go well too jazz. Said the heat, it the last. I change with your fire, they duff the mass. Change with your fire, they duff the mass. I handle road or hundo last. Needs move out the shindle task. It can't go roady, now won't ask. Calling our face and then you're scum. That's enough for the story to run. Sensational airline, that's job done.
Hello.
What's up, Edith?
Hello.
How you doing?
Oh, good. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm very well. I have to apologise. I was supposed to be there in person, but then my little one got poorly, so I've had to not be there in person. So I do apologise. I was so looking forward to sitting down in the same room and chatting to you about your film. So apologies, James.
No worries. Jeez, I hope there's a speedy recovery.
He is fine. He's already been playing drums this morning, so good. He's absolutely fine.
Absolutely. I'm sure you're sick now.
Oh, my
it's
God.
A chill morning.
Jeez, Louise. Listen, I have to say, huge congratulations on this film. It's absolutely brilliant. I didn't want it to end. It was so great.
Oh, that's very nice of you. Appreciate it. Plateau out after the 3,000th time you've watched it, as we can all attest.
I was just going to go straight in and ask if there's going to be a sequel, actually.
Yeah, everyone will be in rehab and or hooked up to IV somewhere, probably.
You'll be in a grave, hopefully.
We're going to start a franchise. It'll be Kneecap 2, 3, 4.
You'll be in articles, one hit wonders.
Kneecap Origin.
It could be like
the Belfast and Furious.
Yeah. Kneecap,
we actually kneecapped, kneecapping, kneecapped again. Do you know what I mean? There's just loads of ways you could work
kneecap
it.
Kneecap this time is personal.
I think Kneecap the Replacement was one that came up.
That's a new one.
Love that. Listen, for people who are listening, because we've got, you know, four of you there, I think, can you just, you know, introduce yourself so that people can really kind of just get those really lovely, delicate differences between everybody's voices so we know who's talking, if that's okay? Would you mind?
I mean, mine's really easy because I'm the only English accent.
DJ Brovic.
Rich.
He's Rich.
I'm Rich Pepe at the writing director of Kneecap.
Makara.
DJ Brovic.
Top Lung Cardigales is Mowgli.
Love it. Amazing. See, even though they are just like, you can really hear the sort of little intricate details of each person's voice. Rich, if you don't mind me starting with you in terms of how you came to know about the lads and their story and this band, because I'm imagining the band was very much present and alive way before there was an idea for a film, or was there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I moved to Belfast a couple of weeks before I'd met the lads, and my wife, we sort of moved from London for a bit of a quieter life, and within 2 weeks I'd fallen in with some Republican rappers.
Fallen in love?
You know what? There was a degree of that. Walking in and seeing, you know, I thought the energy they had, the stage presence. And for me, I felt like my favourite band growing up was Rage Against the Machine. And, you know, they were obviously a really overtly political band. And I felt like a lot of music, the politics had gone out of it. It felt very PR'd and packaged. Yeah. And to see these three lads up there and clearly not giving a toss what anyone thought of what they had to say was just very refreshing. And yeah, I guess there was at the time a big political battle in the north of Ireland around an Irish Language Act, and it was complete gridlock and stasis at a political level. And to have see this grassroots movement of young people getting behind these Irish language rappers, to me was, you know, just an interesting precinct. I think as a filmmaker, when you find a little world that doesn't feel like it's had a camera on it, that's the start of the story, and that then became the big mission of trying to convince them to let me make their film.
Took a long time.
Did it? I was going to ask, did you take much convincing?
Yeah, a lot. It took about nearly 9 months of him convincing us. He was emailing us for a long time. And
he adds a month every time this question comes up. He adds a month.
It was more like three months.
It was
basically a year and a half. He was emailing us, and
it was 3 decades that I was emailing him for.
We were very skeptical, of course. You could probably tell from Rich's voice, he is from England. And for a long time, the Brits have
don't
just,
be so hard on him.
I know, it's not his fault. I don't think it is anyway, but he has that accent because he's from England, and he approached us, and we were very sceptical at first because they have a bad track record of taking advantage of the Irish. So then after a while he got through to us and he bought us some pints of Guinness.
That was the key, is if you buy him Beamish. 3 pints Guinness. Of Beamish, yeah. They'll do anything.
And then we will at least listen to you, and then a few more pints of Beamish, and then we
we'll do anything
and then we got the ball rolling. That was in 2019, so that's near 5 years ago.
We've had a lot more Beamish since.
Where were you as a band, you know, in terms of kind of sort of really cutting through, because that's part of the really lovely story within the film, is in terms of how you almost, as soon as your music is kind of available or even kind of trickling out there, people just grasping onto it because there's such connection to what you're saying, what you're talking about. What was the kind of reality of where you were as a band at that point when Rich was trying to convince you about the film?
We were on a decent trajectory. Like, we were doing really well in Ireland, particularly Belfast and Dublin, the bigger cities. So it was going well. So like that created this extra risk element to doing the film, because obviously the music career was doing so well that it could have quite easily went downhill if we'd done a film that was cheesy or shit. Do you know what I mean? So it could have been like one of those things that like really affected the band. So we knew it was a risk, but we obviously trusted Rich after a few Beamish. We trusted him and knew that, you know.
And he gave us his wallet as well.
He was serious about it. Wallet, passport. Mother's maiden name.
Date of birth.
So we trusted him, and we knew he was very serious about it, and it was something that he actually cared about, and it wasn't just this we throw away film or piece for him. So we trusted him, and it was a risk that was worth taking, and we're glad we did.
The other thing to say is that, you know, from my end of things, it was a risk because a lot of local bands, you know, kind of plateau or break up and things like that, you know what I mean, to start putting all the work in, knowing that, you know, at the time they were a band who hadn't released an album, weren't signed, were rapping in a language not that many people spoke. It didn't exactly scream Hollywood blockbuster. And so there was a big element of risk there. But weirdly, it was so illogical to make a film about them. It came out the other side, and it was like, actually, you know what? Wouldn't it be great if we did this biopic in real time? You know, like, rather than looking back on a career, could you even do a biopic in real time? What sort of shape would that take? And we were sitting on a plane a month ago, going out to LA for the US press tour, and I looked at my phone and I saw a WhatsApp group that we used that I'd set up in 2019, and just to start, you know, talking about the film, and I called it jokingly "Kneecap Goes to Hollywood," And here we were sitting on the plane heading out to Hollywood, and we're like, you know, the serendipity of that, of you know, kind of, I guess, in, you know, we'd sit there having a pint and imagine where we might be with the film. But, you know, for their debut album, Fine Art, to come out and it'd be such a fantastic album, you know, 5 stars across the board, and the same summer as the film, is just like, it's put rocket boosters under everything Kneecap.
It's the connection that it has. You kind of, it's just, you immediately are like on your side. You're immediately kind of with you. And I wanted to ask, because, you know, you say the word biopic there. Tell me a little bit about how you navigated what the story was going to be, and what the narrative of the film was going to be, how true it was to your actual life. But was there any hesitation of keeping anything back, being private, you know, navigating that kind of fact and fiction sort of line?
I think it's a really interesting question, because some people think that the lads playing themselves, it's easy, you play yourself, when actually it's kind of a philosophical nightmare when you're being asked to sort of play a version of yourself. And also, you know, there's a huge amount of bravery, because if I'd asked them to play sort of, I don't know, 6th century knights or something in a film, and the audience sat there and watched the film and went, I don't like that 6th century knight, then it doesn't really affect them. It's kind of like, okay, people didn't like my character. I didn't, you know. But when you put yourself, your life, your family, your choices up on screen, and you're asking an audience then to judge you. And so if the audience had not liked one or all of them or whatever, you know, that's personally vulnerable. And so there's a huge amount of bravery that they showed. And I think people will be surprised. The film isn't just kind of like jokes all the way through. You know, there's a lot of emotional stuff in there too that you know, did involve them having to go places and that were tough. And I'm very proud that they did the job that they did.
Were you apprehensive about that side of it?
I suppose whenever we sat down with Rich writing it, he came to us, we were giving him our life experiences. So people always ask us, you know, how much of the film is true? We like to keep the lines blurred a bit, but I would say about 90% probably. And some of the matter stuff in the story, like, some of the matter stuff is the real stuff.
Yeah, we wanted to tell an authentic story.
Yeah.
On Belfast and the north of Ireland. And like Rich, we would sit with Rich, Manny's Ned, writing the script or going through ideas. And maybe like 2021, like years would pass, and he would ask me, like, is there any other stories? And I'd bring up the story of my christening, where I was christened on a mass rock deep in a forest. And the British Army followed us in a helicopter because they thought they uncovered themselves like an IRA training camp, when it was just a load of Irish speakers in a forest with a priest. I mean, that's pretty suspicious in itself, but that wasn't the case. But it was just stories I got there, and I think we wanted to give as much as possible about our own stories, because that was what made it authentic, and that's what makes it stand out from other films.
I think you'd be surprised how much of it actually comes from, like, there's a lot of stuff that is completely true, like the baptism, and also like the DJ Provy being a teacher first and stuff. But I think you'd be surprised how much of it actually comes from some kind of truth, even the bits that were exaggerated for film.
DJ Provy getting the acid out of the bin. That's a true story.
Allegedly.
Stories were in the community. Do you know what I mean? Some of the things are just stories that, you know, kind of other people, have happened to maybe other people, friends of friends like that. And it's kind of like, you know, the film is about the band, but it's more than that. It's about the people of West Belfast. Yeah. It's about the community. And, you know, we're really happy that, you know, it's resonated back home. You know, we've travelled around the world with the film, and it's been amazing getting the reaction we have from people from all sorts of backgrounds. You know, we're amazed that, you know, a film that's so specifically about the Irish language has resonated with people of all sorts of indigenous cultures and made them reflect on their relationship with their mother tongue has been great. But, you know, all of that would have been a waste if we were taking it back home to West Belfast and, you know, the audiences were like, nah, this ain't us. And we're really happy that they've embraced it and can kind of see themselves, the humour, the crack, all of that kind of reflected in the film.
Yeah, totally. I have such a soft spot because I spent a good chunk of my life co-hosting a radio show with Colin Murray. And so I spent a lot of time going back to Belfast with Colin for, you know, to various things, Katie Daly's, and just sort of hanging out in loads of places that he grew up in as well, sort of thing. Mm. And there is something wonderful about the way that Northern Irish people tell stories, in that there's such beautiful musicality to the way they tell stories, and it's immediately kind of come in sort of thing, you know, sort of. And I just, I think that's maybe partly why I kind of just connected immediately and just wanted to, didn't want it to end and wanted to kind of be in the story with you sort of thing from the start. So yeah, I just thought it was absolutely fantastic. Some absolutely laugh out loud lines as well in this film. For me particularly, Rangers are fucking shite. Into Prodigy Smack My Bitch Up is one of my favourites. I can't wait for my brother to see that as well because he's like a massive Celtic fan. So it's going to be like, for yes!
He's got good taste.
Yeah, totally.
He's got good taste.
Well, I Want to Blow You Like a Brighton Hotel was one that was quite hard to get past certain gatekeepers on the way. There were some discussions over whether that was... we dug our heels in on that.
Yeah, but we can all agree that Maggie Thatcher was a...
fill the gap.
Expletive.
Blankety blank on that one.
Cock and font. She was a cock and font.
She was not a pheasant plucker.
She was a birdie ditch.
The Dr. Dre line as well. Oh my God. It's just all those. Was that a lot of fun? Because, you know, just going back to playing yourselves, but you're writing a script. Or, you know, how much of a script did you write? How much of a script did you follow?
It was very scripted. But here's the thing, it's like, it's really one of the hardest things in film sometimes is you have actors kind of meet up a few weeks before they start a film. It's like, hey, you guys are going to play best mates in this movie, right? Mm. And getting that chemistry working is something that, you know, it misses more often than it hits in films, right? And one thing the lads had is that they're best mates. And you know, so they have this natural chemistry that when they're bouncing between lines, they jump into each other's sentences and things like that. And that was just natural. It wasn't really worked upon. It's just how they communicate. And so, you know, there wasn't a lot of ad-libbing. It was quite scripted. But at the same time, there was enough freedom to allow them to...
finish each other's sandwiches.
A lot of that chemistry also came in small little baggies.
I'm not going to ask how the producers coped on this production at all.
Or appeal for the director. Jesus, oh. It's not the producers. Jeez.
There was a lot of vapes smoked on this set. The first AD, I think he smoked about a vape every five. He finished about five vapes a day, stressed out.
I'm surprised that the amount of glucose powder these lads snorted in this film. I'm surprised they ain't got type 2 diabetes, a lot of them.
Not yet.
What about the live music scenes? Because... you know, again, it's that kind of, you're recreating what is a natural environment for you as a band to perform in, but you've got to be able to capture that, you know, Rich, for filmically, sonically as well and stuff. How are those moments, you know, both in terms of, you know, in those brilliant moments where you're recording stuff, but then also performing in front of audiences, whether it's in the little bar or whether it's in kind of bigger venues?
Well, we kind of, there was, the approach was, you know, from the first gig, it should feel very sort of on the shoulder and kind of rough and ready. And as they progressed, it became more and more professional. And by the time we get to the final sort of climactic gig, it should feel like a proper produced sort of show. And it was an indie film, low budget and all of that. You know, trying to fill a room with hundreds and hundreds of people was tough going. And luckily the lads have got fanatical fans who, you know, were very...
showed up in their droves.
They did. They really sort of had to spend all day, you know, for nothing, standing there.
Listening to the same song on repeat, us doing a million takes of the exact same song, and they're all sitting there and nobody's getting paid.
Sober.
There's no alcohol in the place.
They're sober, and we're not.
The ironic thing about it was we were able to go backstage, and we had a carry out each backstage, so we were coming out performing the gig half cut, looking out at a crowd who were all stone cold sober.
Ah, not all of them, actually. I went out to the crowd. they found their ways.
As you would expect a kneecap crowd.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that ways and means.
That was one of the best things about the film, was that obviously it was low budget, that we did have to rely on fans to come out for them big scenes. Like all the scenes you see with
Fassbender
crowds. All the scenes. Fassbender done it all for free because he loves us. like all the scenes Legend. You see with crowds. Like that 90% of them there, there's a couple of scenes where there was actors there, but most of them are our fans who come out and done it for free. I think they were all promised merch, but I'm not sure if I should
be. I think they got a t-shirt.
I'm sure they did.
Actually, Dundalk never got it, so yeah. Big Jack Tarling, get that.
It's in the post.
Yeah, better be.
It's in the post.
It is.
But that audience and that fan base is kind of, you know, is stretching far and wide now, you know, in terms of, look at that response at Glastonbury. What was that like?
Oh, yeah, that was magical. It was insane. We didn't, like, you laugh, man. We didn't expect that kind of crowd.
That was her.
That was her laughing.
Sorry, I thought that was Richard.
No, that was her laughing.
He thought we were. Sorry, I was trying
to make fun of Richard.
I laugh like a man. It's all right.
No, you don't. You don't. I listen like a lady.
Sorry for listening like
Jesus.
A lady.
Sorry for that, Richard.
Atmosphere's changing. It's intense.
So we had the gig at 11:30 in the morning, which is very unusual time to have a gig. I've never been to a gig at 11:30 in the morning. Never mind playing a gig at 11:30 in the morning. We had to get up at 8:00 because it takes about 2 hours to get to the concert. And there's about 8,000 people there.
Yeah, and we had people run around after us all day trying to keep us sober because we had another gig at 1 a.m, which was a tall task. So I don't know how we actually made it to Shangri-La. We do know how we made it, but it's not for radio.
Yeah.
Practice.
What is, have you noticed a difference as a band from the reaction the films had? You know, even that it's not out in the UK yet, there's been so much kind of, you know, celebration of it already, you know, and it's been released obviously in different parts of the world so far. But have you felt that kind of response as a band from people in terms of people reaching out to you or
100%? There's definitely that buzz around the album and the film coming out around the same time. So I think people are sick of us. We're on buses and everything now. I think people have had enough of us. I think people in Belfast in particular.
It's like the whole of Ireland feels like a kneecapped Disneyland at the moment. Every bus that passes has got their faces on it. My kids are 5 and 6, and every 5 minutes sitting in the car and it's like, kneecap, everywhere you go.
I'm sick of us. And so I can only imagine what people...
Their favourite song is Rhino Cat, isn't it?
Yeah, my kids love their song Rhino Cat, because it's got a rhino in it. So and I'm like, it's not really the main thing of it, girls. But they're like the one about the animals, the song about the animals, the rhino song.
You think it's Rhino Cat?
Oh man, that's brilliant! Can we talk about the album? Because there's, you know, in terms of the soundtrack, the album that's coming out, you know, in kind of collaboration with the film, it's you, but it's also this lovely kind of companion score that's been done for the film, and then also all these other artists as well. Talk to me a little bit about kind of putting that together and those choices with who would be. I mean, it feels like, you know, I'm doing Radio 2 this week, actually. I'm sitting for Joelle, and we've got Fontaine's DC as our kind of, you know, the new album for Friday, celebrating that and playing a different track every night. And that feels like an obvious and beautiful kind of partnership to have them part of it, but you know, the choices of who's on that.
Yeah, obviously you have the Fontaines in there, and we had Graham and Tom from the Fontaines on Better Way to Live and on a few other tracks as well, with Thomas drumming on them, and they'd be good friends of ours now at this stage. And then we have Orbital doing Belfast, and they actually did a remix of it for
talking about the album.
Oh, was it the album?
Yeah, no, Orbital didn't do anything, they had nothing to do with the album.
Orbital said they're massive fans of the album.
But obviously, it's one of them. So Ireland's so small, obviously, that like the degrees of separation aren't that big. So you can imagine how small the Irish music scene is. So like you end up at festivals, you get to know these people and stuff. And what we like to do, our tactic is we like to get the person that we want on the album drunk, and then get them to sign contracts that they're going to be on the album, and then we've got it in writing then that they're absolutely trapped,
legally binding
in our web.
That's the good thing about Ireland, because it's so small, that like all these different bands, like Fontaines, and then you have Radio from Lancome, and like Mankin.
Orbital.
You have all these people who
What's
do...
What's the Orbital thing then? What is the reason?
Orbital, but you know, Belfast, you know, one of Orbital's most famous tracks, and the guys agreed to let us use it, but then they went, you know what, we've kind of had a look where you want to use it, and actually we'd like to do a bespoke record of it. So we'd like to re-record it. And we kind of discussed it and had the idea, what about we took the vocals from who's Nisha's ma in the film, Simone Kirby, and we use that vocal instead of the vocal that's actually in the Orbital track. And so they swapped it out. And so Brilliant. For the film, we have like this really cool version of Belfast that just, you know, that's just like, you know, they love their music, and it just shows proper artists. Do you know what I mean? They could have just gone, yeah, lads, here you go, you can have it. But they really wanted to kind of, you know, go in there, get under the bonnet and do their best work. And I think we had that throughout the film, is just people really felt that they were involved in something special and just wanted to bring their A game. And so it was a real pleasure in that part.
It's going to go off at Reading and Leeds this weekend, isn't it? It's going to be amazing.
Hopefully, but we're playing very early. Is it like 1:30?
I think it's 1:30 in Reading and 1:30 in Leeds.
First on.
Third on.
Well, fair
on,
it
started on in the morning at Glastonbury. That's like middle of the night.
That's true.
Comparison to
true, actually. Yeah. 11:30 in the morning. That was very early. This is a late gig.
These festival bookers need to have a look at themselves. Yeah. I don't know what they're thinking.
Exactly.
Playing at 1:30 in Reading, just after the watershed.
Yeah, Rhino Cat, 1 p.m.
Rhino Cat, as it's now.
Rhino Cat.
And I mean, talk about kind of a beautiful Christmas gift. The SSE Arena in Belfast just before Christmas this year is 6,000 people.
I'm no good at judging crowds.
How does that feel?
I think it's about 60,000.
70,000. 6 million. 60,000.
60,000.
Yeah. 60 million people. In
roughly, give or take.
Taylor Swift, unlucky.
No, it's great. It's great. We actually done, it's exactly a year to the day.
Exact same day. Yeah.
We played at the Ulster Hall in Belfast, which is obviously, I think Ulster Hall is like 1,700
million. Such an iconic venue though, that.
Yeah. A building that was built.
A bastion
for unionism. No, a building that was built that they would never assume that someone from a Republican or a Catholic area would ever step foot in. So in walks us singing Get Your Brits Out. So it's obviously great to see the exponential rise in the last year that we're doing the SSE.
We've come a long, long way together.
Through the hard times and the good.
Yeah. So it's just good to celebrate.
Celebrate, you baby. I'm going to praise you like I should.
Nice.
Exactly. Battlelands as well is a special place in my heart.
Best venue of all time.
And we get to do it. Two nights in a row is incredible.
The wee springy floors. The wee springy floors.
Wee springy floors.
For all the wee owl dolls' knees.
Oh, man. Listen, I'm so excited for people to see this film. I just think that for me, it had, and I know that there's been lots of people kind of referencing different films and stuff as well, but like when I was growing up, Trainspotting did have a really special place for me in terms of what it was saying about Scotland and, you know, and just kind of the honesty that it kind of had. To kind of characters that you never saw on screen.
Yeah.
And I really think that this is doing a, you know, not a similar thing, but for me, it had that same feeling of just, God, this is so refreshing. This is so fun. This is so great. And it's got that brilliant musical element to it that's so important to the story. I'm really excited to see where you go, you know, as a band. And just, I really do hope there's a sequel.
It took Danny Boyle 20 years to do Trainspotting 2. So,
28 to do 28 years later. Do you know what I mean? So it's
That's true. Well, yeah, I mean, look, it's certainly a labour of love as all independent film are. But, you know, we're really excited ourselves. It's been 8 months of sort of revving the engine with the handbrake on a little bit to sort of get it out there. And we're excited that the audiences are starting to see it. And you know, this Friday or kind of this Friday is kind of the end of our sort of big press tour. You know, so most of the main territory is going to be out then, and so we're going to be finally not having to talk about ourselves for a while.
Well, I don't know how Rich will deal with that. I'm sure he'll find some poor soul in the pub.
His wife.
I haven't spoken to her in 8 months, don't you? The only thing she gets to talk to me is listens to the radio or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Who's that on the radio?
Do you want to give her a shout out whilst we're on?
Danielle Pepiat. Love you, Callia, Emily. Aww.
Danielle.
Miss you all.
I love you. I hope you're doing
Danielle,
well.
Danielle, love you. Miss the kids.
Shout out to Anya and Danny and Sonny as well.
Yeah, and Danielle as well.
Just before we go, I just wanted, because you mentioned Simone Kirby, who plays one of your mums, and Fassbender obviously coming in here to support the film kind of behind the scenes as well, was obviously on camera. He's just brilliant in this. He's so, you know, the little kind of scenes that he's in sort of thing. I feel like it's been a while since we've seen him on screen as well. So it's been, this is a kind of the perfect thing for him to come back.
Well, it was one of the things we discussed with him is like, you know, I think that playing Bobby Sands was one of his, you know, iconic roles for him. Like, you know, I think it was the role that really connected with him. And I think you may have said to me it's his favourite role that he's ever played. And so for, you know, one of the things we discussed very early on was that the role of Arlo, Nisha's father in the film, is kind of like it had been the guy in a cell next to Bobby Sands, the guy who didn't go on the blanket, the guy who didn't go on hunger strike. And how would that guy's life have gone? And I think that was something that really connected with Michael was, you know, he could kind of explore a similar character in a slightly different way. And it was just having him on set was fantastic. I mean, everyone brought their A game when he was there. The catering got better. That was a big thing. You see him, as a director, you're looking down your monitor and you see Michael Fassbender there and you have to pinch yourself a bit and go, is this bloke actually in my film? Or am I just imagining this? Mm-hmm. This is, he's so controlled over his performance. And yeah, he was just very, very generous in terms of his time, in terms of helping the lads, helping me. And yeah, we were just very, very happy to have him. Nish is now going to go stay at his house. So,
nice.
There you go. They're all friends for life.
I mean, Nish, what's like having him as your dad in the film?
Yeah, it was cool. He was actually very chilled out and laid back doing all the scenes. We used to just watch like funny videos between every scene.
Used to play catch in the yard.
Yeah. Used to throw the ball at each other, and he's very complimentary. Now, cool. He was, as they said, like the better the actor, the easier it is. Like acting with these two beside me was really hard because they're so shit. But like acting with Fassbender was a breeze.
It's all about reacting. Acting's all about reacting.
If you're in your head, you're dead. Make a stronger choice. There will be no script on the night.
That was all freestyle.
The film will not be televised.
unless you have a fire stick.
No. People, it's funny how many people come up to you and go, I saw the film on the fire stick the other day, and you're like, oh.
And the wrong person you should be telling that to.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Cheers for that.
Go and buy a ticket.
I know.
Still in the cinemas.
Fuck, go and stream it illegally.
It's the quality's awful though. Do you know what I mean? It's not the same as being, you know, you need to be in a, it is a film that,
be in a room and
exactly, it rewards collective viewing. It's a film that rewards collective viewing, proper sound system, proper big screen. It's like, it's worth it. And I think that, you know, cinema is having a bit of an existential crisis. And, I think that for, hopefully, Kneecap's the sort of film that makes people realise, get back out to the cinema, sit in a dark room with a bunch of strangers and have a bit of a laugh.
Get out of your house.
Get out of your head.
Exactly.
And into my car.
Like your mom.
You can't even drive.
We've run out of time, but I want to say thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And just huge congratulations as well. And you know, thanks as well for being so open and honest about sharing your story, you know, in this form as well, because it's incredibly rewarding for me as a film and music fan to watch this. So
thank you, Edith.
Huge congratulations.
Thank you. Any chance you could get us on Top of the Pops?
I wish it was still on the telly.
Next time it comes back,
old grey whistle test. Have us on the list.
The first thing I'm going to do now is to see if you've got any clean versions of any of the songs that can be played on the radio.
We clean them up for Top of the Pops, definitely.
Yeah, we've
just get them on radio too. Yeah. Yeah. I want to be the person that plays Kneecap on radio.
You got it.
Nice. We get that.
Yeah.
Exclusive.
Yeah, I'm on it.
Leave it with us.
More time.
I'm on it. I'll I don't know what I need to do.
Yeah, I understood it.
You know what I mean, eh?
Yeah, for sure.
We'll bleep it up there.
Have a great day. Happy release for next
week.
Thank
you so
much.
Have
the most brilliant time at Reading and Leeds. And I look forward. I'm going to try to get one of those Barrowlands gigs as well up in Scotland.
Oh, so, we get you tickets.
Have a great one.
Thank
you.
Morning,
time.
Thanks.
Take
care. Thanks.
Take care. Bye.
Fucking catch a mockery. Boriak Pendila, Boriak Snake. She was a cocktail bread for unleashing the beast. He had wore a mock for nigh at least. Dredgella, he's beating some fella. Tahan or UC and Sean, it's for sure she to sell out. Fucked into the back of the Jeep. He falls asleep. He does it every week. Chucky or La, get the Brits out, lad. A one way ticket, please. I've lost my bus pass.
Featured in their brilliant film, that's H-O-O-D by Kneecap, rounding off the first part of this soundtrack and special. And now it's time to hear from Mikey J, who scored the film. This is his cue, Civil Rights.
I love.
Thank you so much for your time.
Not all good, man. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Oh, wow. Well, listen, you're very much part of the team behind this phenomenal creative explosion that is Kneecap.
Wow. So that's cool. I'm talking to a friend.
Oh, man, I loved it so much. I didn't want it to end. I just wanted more.
Wow. And so am I sensing a bit of an accent?
Yeah, there's a Celtic connection there. I'm Scottish, so weirdly as well, I spoke to the boys yesterday. I was telling them that I used to do a radio show on Radio 1 with them, a Northern Irish presenter called Colin Murray. And so I spent every day, Monday to Friday, doing a live radio. And we're still really good friends, you know, for 5 years of my life. So I don't know, I have this lovely connection with Belfast and, you know, with that history and with that world.
Nice.
But listen, this film's just, it's such a firecracker, and it's something that's so, it's so refreshing, actually, because it's funny, I was having this conversation with someone a couple of weeks ago about how our musicians are not as kind of politicized or opinionated or driving change or driving people to not necessarily kind of telling them to make the right choices, but just to give them the facts and give them the information. Yeah. You know what I mean? And I feel like
at least a different perspective. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the many things that I love about the film and the boys and just the whole energy of the thing. How did you come to be involved in the project?
So initially, I'd been asked to do the show first off. I'll say it like that. But I wasn't available, right? I had was working another show called Free Your Mind with Danny Boyle and my dance company, Boy Blue, up in Manchester.
Yeah.
So we started working on that, and I'd committed. So, you know, I'd committed to that. So I said the times that they were trying to do stuff, it didn't 100% work. So I said I couldn't do it. Time passed. I think they used a couple of people. They worked with a couple of people. But I just guess it wasn't gelling. And next minute I got a call and they said, how can we make this work? And pretty much I knocked it. Well, the main kind of vein of what it needs to be, probably in 30 days of November last year. So, yeah, but, you know, in between that, it was meeting Rich. In between that, it was then going to Belfast to see the boys.
Yeah.
And they were really trying to sell me. They said, we think you can achieve this. I was like, I'm not too sure. I hope I can. But, yeah, watching it and everything, yeah, it just felt like something I definitely could add my voice to.
And what was the thing for you in terms of that you connected with, would you say, you know, in terms of, you know, hearing them, hearing what they were doing already, hearing their story, meeting them as well. What was the thing for you that you wanted to be part of it?
If I'm honest, from the jump, you know, and I think this is part of the journey, which is really great, because like the track that, well, the name of the track is called Ceasefire Babies. It's the one that they use as the promo.
Yeah.
You hear that story that you just never, ever heard before. The notion of, yeah, once us as Brits anyway, once we heard, you know, ceasefire is now there, we didn't think about, so what happens next?
Mm.
And it was really a sense of, I wanted to make sure I did a good job, because I realized how important it was for them in terms of the storytelling, in terms of the journey that they've all kind of been through as young Irish men, and where they're going, and how hip hop, which is always great to see hip hop as an essence or an element that helps supporting them to have a voice. So more than anything else, it was just, I wanted to do a good job and make sure that what they wanted to achieve, I was able to kind of connect that truth for them.
They called our generation the ceasefire babies. As if our only defining feature was we were not the shit that came before us. Maybe they were right. Maybe we were only ever going to be the moment after the moment. Just as fucked up and miserable as the last. Only with less chance of getting blown up to escape it all. But we still found ways to escape it all.
You've heard of intergenerational trauma, right?
Right.
Our history?
Our history has become our biology. It's like the trauma our ancestors suffered
has inserted itself.
It's actually inserted itself into our genetic code. Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Psychological reverberations.
Reverberations. ADHD. ODD.
The troubles?
The troubles? I've got fucking troubles.
One of the things that I love about the music and the quality of the production and stuff, both, you know, within the film, is that there feels like there's a real affinity and admiration for the history of hip hop in terms of the beats that are being used and even the instrumentation, you know, in terms of when the 808 comes out on, you know, as part of the narrative and things like that. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of, it's old school, things that are embedded in the history of that genre of music. And I love that that's very much part of their music, their journey within the film.
Yeah, I think what you're kind of landing on is the notion of going to what your original point was what was the original point of hip hop as an element? It was there to allow people in a specific part of town with specific problems the opportunity to be able to speak. Mm. And knowing that, you know, an art form from there, and I think they've spoken about it, even in the film they speak about what it did for the young black youth in America, then I think about what it's done for me in the UK and how then it's transformed and turned into our own genres. And yeah, then at the same time, yeah, to know it's done that, it just shows you the truth of what music can do and the truth and the power of hip hop as a voice for the voiceless.
There's a brilliant line in the film as well where that mentions Dr. Dre, which I just like proper belly laughed out loud, where it's like, well, excuse me for holding you back or something for your meeting with Dr. Dre. And it's just, yeah, it's just kind of all these little kind of little moments, and I kind of love that because it's contemporary and it's now, but it's almost kind of slightly timeless. I think it could have been set in the 90s or whatever, you know, in terms of the music that they're making, and I really love that.
Yeah, I mean, I really, it's authenticity at the end of it all, you know, even though they deal with some challenging concepts, right, in the show, both, you know, whether you talk about drugs specifically or the notion of the political aspects of their upbringing.
Yeah.
It's done in an authentic way, which allows you to kind of say, okay, I accept that, I'm going with it, you know, and you choose to not, I guess, in the way that, number one, let's take a moment for the fact that these people aren't actors, you know, they've had to learn this skill, you know, all three of them are just exceptional. And JJ, man, he is like incredible in it. I when I first met JJ, yeah, I was like, so are you an actor? And he goes, no, he was one of the
yeah,
one of the band. And I was like, what? Like, seriously, I know you're part of the band, but wait, hold on a second. Have you ever done that before, you know? But yeah, more than anything else, they're just being authentic about it. So you say, okay, I'm going to listen to that truth and I'm going to allow it to be a part of my viewing experience without any judgment.
It's so true. And also asking non-actors not just to act but to play a version of themselves,
yeah,
it's like that's not easy.
It can't be, no.
Yeah,
be, no. But I think that's where, you know, Rich and the boys, in terms of their journey, that's where that kind of came, because I know that they consistently you know, would challenge Rich with the idea of how, you know, what things should sound like, what things should look like, and they have had that interplay, which obviously shows itself well on screen.
Yeah. The album's out, which is great. And the album's this wonderful kind of introduction to, so it will be an introduction for so many people into their music, but it also encompasses, you know, lots, there's quite a few other artists on there as well, you know, whether it be Fontaines DC featuring on there as well. And I love that within the album, they've also included, because I remember watching Good Morning Vietnam, and I listened to that on cassette like nonstop when I was like younger. Okay. And I love how on the soundtrack for it, they included little clips of when Robin Williams was doing those kind of radio, you know, bits, you know, Time to Rock You from the Delta to the D, you know, all that stuff was on before it went into the tracks. And they've done that on this as well, which is great in terms of those little clips of the, so it just really kind of immerses you in the world even more, which is such a great idea. How involved were you in the, you know, in the construction of everything that's on that album, you know, in terms of, yeah, I mean, what's on it and how it sounds, really?
Yeah, so obviously I came in later in the game.
Yeah.
I would definitely say Toddler T, he was the main driving force by the album, you know, and for the album. So by the time I've come to meet them, the album was complete. And if anything, I just drew inspiration of what the track should sound like,
you know, from
the original score's point of view.
Yeah.
To make sure that there was that marriage between what's their tracks and what actually has to happen to drive the story across.
Yeah.
So more than anything else, yeah, it was just kind of deciphering which tool bag to use, and the album helped to kind of do that. And they gave me access to all the parts, you know, but I tried my best to kind of let that be what it is and try and create something fresh directly for the film and the narrative journey, of course.
Yeah, and I imagine within that, the conversation is there are so many kind of variables that you have to consider within that. Do you know what I mean? Whether it's the environment, the emotion within the scene, you know, where that scene's going, where it's come from, and maybe, you know, whether there's it's kind of bookended by music in itself sort of thing. So
yeah,
there's a lot for you to consider to craft what you're you know, what you're making.
Yeah, it's thinking about what is the subgenres of hip hop and kind of deciphering whether or not that one is the right one to use. A good example is the cue, which I call Run, which is the scene where, you know, they get met by the police at the illegal rave.
Yeah.
By the end of it, Noisha's like at the bus stop, and you know, he's too high to kind of see everything, and everyone's like the same material as the bus and all of that. Like that, the notion of using the drum and bass to kind of get the pace, and then taking it, even though maybe it's a bit more cliche, using kind of the Bashment sound to kind of give that psychedelic vibe and energy that makes it feel like clouds are above their heads, you know? So just deciphering which sounds will give the scene the perfect edge, but keep it still in that playbook of hip hop and the subgenres that exist around it.
There are so many of those kind of moments where, you know, them as a band where they're creating themselves and they're probably inebriated in some way, shape or form from something. Obviously, clearly not. Anyway, I'll leave that.
But yeah, acting.
They're acting. Of course they are. They're using that personal experience, real life experience they had into this performance. Uh-huh. But it's all those moments as well, do you know, that you have to colour them well and colour them right around how those characters are reacting and what's mental state they're in and all that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, I think more than anything else, as I said, the tool was, just thinking about the subgenres, considering the tempo, considering, like, even taking Run again as an example, I had to go back into my time as a 14-year-old and think about what is the right kind of vocal chops that need to be in that. What is the breakbeat from that era that I need to call upon to kind of bring into this moment? Because yeah, that style is so much drum and bass per se is very, very different to what it is was then than it is now. But I really wanted to kind of harp on the nostalgic element for the sake of the film and that of its strong roots with the next track, which is, you know, it's all from the same dancehall space, you know, that's what drum and bass is kind of built from. So that was really, really cool, kind of having to use my experience as a youth to kind of bring that into the show for today.
When I was about 14, similar age, we were talking about 3 Feet High and Rising was the album for me that I could not get. I used to go to this little club in Dunfermline called The Cronk. They would just play like as much of the album as they could. I was totally underage, hiding underneath the DJ booth sort of thing, but just like, I just couldn't get enough of it. And there are elements kind of within, you know, with that album and its kind of storytelling and its narrative that it kind of takes you through that I think that I kind of really saw a lot or felt a lot of almost like the beautiful kind of production in that within this film as well, in terms of kind of, where it's taken me.
Wow. You're taking, you know, that's a compliment that I don't know how to really take, really, more than anything else. But I think more than anything else, as I said, it was the authenticity. It was kind of focusing on the fact that hip hop is our driver. How can I best, you know, represent, number one, that vibe. Number two, the culture in terms of their culture and that of hip hop in their mother tongue. And then also, the authenticity of the story. You know, it all was just so cool. it came about and became such a cool thing to work on. And I had no expectations. I'm guessing they would have said the same to you. We had no expectations that it would have this kind of riotous response.
It's infectious. That's what it is. It's kind of, they're that kind of like lovable rogue type sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? I mean, they're one step further than that. I was really kind of impressed as well when we were talking yesterday about how much of their real story is in there.
Yeah.
You know, how much of them is actually in this film and how much of that story is them and their experiences and their lives.
I mean, did you manage to stay to the credits?
Yes. And that the shot of his christening. Oh, yeah. My God.
You know what I mean?
No way.
Was that real? That was the first thing, yeah, that Liam kind of told me about Noisha, in the sense that, because I met him first before Noisha kind of popped up. But more than anything else, it was like, yeah, they said that actually happened. The bending of the truth is in there for sure. But, you know, a lot of it is kind of based on their true experience and their true reality. I think that's what makes it so lovable in a roundabout way, because you can believe that this could potentially happen, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You're such an interesting, you know, character in terms of this lovely kind of, it's so refreshing as well when you see artists that kind of push outside of that kind of expectation of being pigeonholed into things. And that's something that you kind of really definitely do. You know, you don't fit in one box, considering the amount and the variety of work that you do. And I wanted to, if you didn't mind, just talking a little bit about Boy Blue, because I think it's just nice to get the opportunity to kind of talk about it and 100%. Kind of celebrate it as well and stuff. And I was just really interested about what was the inspiration about setting it up, really.
I mean, in part, there was always this love for dance for me. I danced up until like 23 years old only because I thought music was the thing I needed to focus on. And
and
I proved my 23 year old self has proved my 44 year old self that, yeah, that was the way to go, Mike. but on the flip side, it was like, yeah, you know, my friend who is my business partner, Ken, you know, I saw what he was trying to do and trying to develop as a dancer. And I said, yeah, let's turn this into a thing, because I actually wanted to support him. I wanted him to have something solid for himself and build that. But then also we had this massive community energy, you know, where these young people, you know, found whether it was the opportunity to kind of find something new and fresh for themselves. Some of them we did catch because there was girls in there. They're like, there's girls there. So the boys came and the next minute they got intrigued and wanted to dance and stay. And then some people, yeah, you know, they're battling all the other things, and dance for them was a massive release. And so the more and more we kind of responded to our community, the more and more it seemed that this responsibility was important.
Yeah.
So we continue to kind of make that grow. And then the shows turned into, one show turned into two shows, turned into three shows. And then, yeah, 23, 24 years later now, you know, that company's been running. And, you know, we've done big events like the Olympics. You know, we worked on that with Danny at the 2012 Olympics in the big scene called Thanks Tim, which was talking about Tim Berners-Lee. And then, yeah, we've done our own shows, like most recently Cycles, which is just a hip hop event and a vibe that kind of hit us and is at the Barbican. So, yeah, you don't really say you've got a plan. You know, you just try and have a go, and all of a sudden it just turns into a whirlwind of different things. But Boy Blue has always afforded me, like you said, that opportunity to kind of do something else, because where I'm from, essentially, at that time, they just wanted us to make records that fit that 3 minute mark, that 4 minute mark. And I always had an idea which was expanded. I wanted to make 90 minutes worth of score, right? I didn't know it was score at the time. So it definitely helped and informed where I'm at today with stuff like Kneecap, for sure. And really it honed, it must be honing my skills, at least, to kind of allow for our music, meaning hip hop music and that of his subgenres, to be able to fit inside, you know, a show, a film such as Kneecap, you know?
Yeah. And when it comes to theatre as well, you know, it's been a big part of your career as well, you know, in terms of creating for theatre. What do you love about that medium of expression?
Oh, man, it's the visceral nature of the direct response and the fact that each one, meaning show, can be different each time. You know, even though, yes, my stuff is on a Q-Lab, it gets pressed, you just don't know how it's going to affect. And that's the difference, right? The difference between me meeting you maybe 10 years from now and talking about a record that I did that really affected you, and seeing that happen in the space, having that energy fill you and hit you in the space. And then watching the artist grow as well, right in front of your eyes, taking the role on. You know, the theatre world has always been so exciting to me because it's a box. And in that box, we have to transport you. So I've always very, very, very privileged that I'm able to work in that scene for sure.
Where do you start though when you're working on something, you know, that is so, has been, is revered and has been interpreted so many times, something like Romeo and Juliet?
You start obviously with the director's vision, and for argument's sake, working on Romeo and Juliet most recently with Jamie, you know, he first comes and tells me, this is what I'm thinking and feeling. And then I go, okay, I try and interpret that into some kind of sonic signature.
Mm.
But more than anything else, it's just that tugging and pulling of trying things, sending it across and seeing if it works. So generally you move and you start with a sense of the first things you're going to send are going to be rubbish and no one's going to like them. That's the kind of attitude you have to have. You have to kind of know that nothing is precious at this moment until we create, and what I call is making the pen. So I break the pen from the other show and I have to make a whole new pen for this new show, and then finding that language as we go along. So to be honest, it's really exciting. But then also on the flip side, yeah, it can be nerve-wracking in the sense that what you could have spent, you know, 2-3 weeks on certain things and then it's just not working and you have to do something fresh. But yeah, I mean, slyly as well, you try your best to put the noise of all the other productions aside and try and focus on what the storytelling needs to be in this circumstance.
Yeah.
And what Jamie wanted to do that time was a little bit darker. You know, he took a spin of Romeo and Juliet to kind of say, when we think about certain conversations and scenarios surrounding what was going on, it looked more like this to him. So it had more of a darker tone. So then instantly the pen started being fashioned to be a little bit more darker.
I haven't seen it yet, but is it still on? I hope it's still on.
No,
no,
and I don't think it'll come back. Yeah, I don't think it'll come back. It was very, very different. Very, very, very different telling. I think some people really, really liked the way he broke the energy, but some people missed the pomp and circus of what Romeo and Juliet usually is. But it's what you get from a, you know, a Jamie Lloyd show, you know?
Yeah. I grew up and I didn't really... Theatre wasn't really accessible for me from my little fishing village in Scotland. And I definitely went quite a lot pre-COVID, but post-COVID, I've just been quite hungry for it.
Great.
I saw that amazing Dorian Gray with Sarah Snook from Succession.
Yeah,
that
I never got to see that.
So and amazing. Yep. Like literally you come out, you're going, how have we done that?
Yep.
Oh, it's absolutely bonkers.
Yeah.
And what's next? Do you have a whole kind of succession of things kind of that you're working on, all those plates spinning, you know, things thrown out and you're going, yeah, I'll try that.
I do. And it's always challenging in these circumstances because it's how much can you talk about? You
know? Yeah, of course, yeah. I have it every episode where it's like, so, and you go, can't tell you.
Yeah, I mean, I'll put it to you like this. There is something on TV that I'm working on that will be coming out sometime this year. Well, actually, the album for the last show we did called Cycles from a Boy Blue Perspective, that's going to be released in a week. And that's just a vibe, hip-hop piece of music. And then, yeah, there is another theatre production that should be happening by the end of the year as well. So all three spaces, other than film, there's something at least Mikey's been involved in.
Wow, amazing. I'm going to come and see whatever that new theatre thing is for sure.
Okay,
yeah, that one's, for sure.
That one's pretty big and it will be on the West End. But yeah, just give me a knock and then I'll let you know.
I'll get you back on so we can have another chat about it and the TV show as well, for sure.
There's no problem.
Please.
No problem.
listen, it's so great to chat to you. I really appreciate your time and huge congratulations. Such an important part to the experience of Kneecap, which I said to them yesterday, I was like, I hope there's a sequel. I want more. And I'm gutted I'm not at Reading and Leeds this weekend to watch them live as well.
That has been shocking seeing, because, yeah, I mean, music does what music does, but people probably can't understand what they're saying in part if they're not from, you know, that part of the world from where they're from. But you can just see how no matter what, it's so infectious. You need to see a live show. It's wicked.
I think I'm going to head up to the Barrowlands in Scotland. That's going to be a good one, I think. Mikey, so lovely to chat to you and get to meet you. And huge congratulations on this wonderful journey you've been on so far. And I look forward to seeing where it takes you as well. And we get to chat again.
That. Thank you very, very much, Edith.
My pleasure.
Oh,
to Kneecap. That's Dad's Gone by Mikey J, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking. My huge thanks to Mikey, Rich and the lads for taking the time to join us. Kneecap is available on home entertainment formats now, and you should also check out their latest album, Fine Art. Head to edithbowman.com to find every single episode of the podcast, while you can follow us on your socials at Soundtracking UK. Also, if you head to our YouTube channel, Soundtracking Extra, we've got an exclusive chat with the two young, hugely talented ladies whose job it was to write original songs for Moana 2, Barlow and Bear. So that chat is up there talking about Moana 2. So if you want to listen to that, just head to our YouTube channel, which is Soundtracking Extra. Guests are coming thick and fast pre-Christmas, so we'll be back to start the week with Zoe Saldana talking about Emilia Perez, and Keira Knightley and Joe Barton talking about their new Netflix show, which is called Black Doves. Both brilliant, both deserve your attention, and available now. So why not go and watch them both before joining us for our next episode of Soundtracking? I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.